So last week, we started at the temple, and this is where Jesus very symbolically pronounced his condemnation on the institution itself. And we talked about how him overturning the money-changing tables, there we go, really wasn't because the exchange rate was bad, but rather it signified something much deeper, that there was rot in Jerusalem and ultimately at the core of the temple. And as it turns out, that is corroborated by multiple sources, even outside the Bible. It was well known. And from there, the clock starts ticking. There's a lot of moments where that kind of happens, that Jesus continues down this trajectory. And that's really where things start, because those in authority over the temple understand the message that Jesus was sending. Now, over the next week, Jesus will spend his time, for the most part, teaching, preaching, that sort of thing, being with the people in the temple complex. And Jerusalem is very crowded at this time. Some estimates say that it would swell by about 300,000 people. So you can imagine the smell more than anything. But during this time, the religious elite, and since we're in Luke, it's primarily the chief priests, send their quite literal best and brightest to find a way to trap Jesus, get him to say something stupid, something that they can act on. This is where conversations like, do we pay this tax to Caesar or not? And if Jesus says yes, they could say, see, he's just in love with Roman power. If he says no, then they can go to Pilate and say, yeah, you might want to take care of this guy. Jesus, every single time, of course, shoots them down in some very, had to have been frustrating for them. I imagine it was amazing for the crowds, because the crowds were not stupid. They knew not to fully trust, especially the religious elite that were ripping them off. But the fact that they couldn't trap Jesus meant that they had to find another way to get him. And because they knew they couldn't do it publicly, he was too popular and it was too crowded, they needed somebody on the inside. Evidently, there was. To quote one particular New Testament scholar in explaining the conundrum that is Judas, he said, Judas is Judas. We have some theories. I'm not going to go into them right now because they really don't matter. That somewhat helpfully explain why he might have done what he did. But ultimately, we have to have the humility to say we don't know for certain. Now, he's waiting for that moment, apparently, and it's going to be his job to let them know when Jesus is vulnerable. And this would be in the evening, at night, when most everybody is in bed or at least close to wherever they're staying. And Judas is, by this point, poised, ready to act. While that's happening, Jesus has sent his disciples into Jerusalem. Apparently, they know somebody there, considering Jesus went probably multiple times a year, every year of his life. Of course, they knew somebody. And he sent them to find this particular guy, and when you find him, to say, the master needs his guest room. I'm slightly paraphrasing there. But there's a curious linguistic thing happening right there, and I haven't decided if it's meaningful or not. In narrating that story, Luke uses a very rare word. It's used only three times in the New Testament. And it means upper room, usually is how it's translated. It can be a guest room. And it's actually the same word that's used to describe the room that Jesus was born in that was apparently too small, requiring Mary to go out to the main room and put him in a manger. I can't decide if that's significant. And by that I mean Luke only uses this word twice, then and there. And these are both very, very important moments in the life of Jesus and in the life of human history. I mean, when he's born, this is when the Creator takes on flesh and enters the world. This is the culmination of God's plan to send somebody. And then as Jesus is having this final meal with his disciples, he's about to show them what he's really about to do. And he's going to do it in a way that he can then be present with Christians for the rest of our history. That feels significant. What I don't know is what Luke intended. Does he mean for us to draw a line between those two or not? And to some extent, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. Because that feels really, really meaningful, whether he knew it or not. We'll just blame the Holy Spirit. But nonetheless, Jesus finds himself in this room. He's celebrating Passover. And he's doing it on the wrong day. He's doing it on Thursday. You do this on Friday. Somewhat flippantly, you can say, well, it's because he knew he was going to be busy on Friday. I don't know if that's blasphemous or not. But it's not unlike Jesus to take a tradition of his people that is deep and meaningful and mutate it into something else or make it fit his needs. Jesus does this a few times. One of the most important times he does this is the ritual washing that a good observant Jewish person would do, that Jesus then turns to his disciples right before he takes his throne in the heavens and says, now you go do that. We call this baptism. He does it in a few other places, but it's not unlike him. His disciples will actually do this too. And there comes a point where they recognize, yeah, Shabbat, Sabbath, is the holy day. And all our lives, we've celebrated Shabbat on Shabbat, which we would call Saturday. And eventually they will say, yeah, but Jesus rose on a Sunday. We're doing it on that day. And so we have ever since. I like the fact that there's flexibility there. That, although subtle, Jesus and his disciples take these very deep, meaningful rituals and experiences that teach them about God, and yet they treat them with a certain fluidity that allows them to remain fresh and adapt itself. There's something there. So, regardless, Jesus is eating Passover on the wrong day with his disciples. It's very clearly a Passover. We do not know what first century Passover looked like. We don't have a first century Agadah, which is like the liturgy book of Passover. The ones that we have come from a couple hundred years later, which means we can kind of guess, but we can't be certain. And I know I've been to at least two. Modern Christians will kind of do some sort of Seder meal as a way of getting back to those roots and understanding the symbolism there. We just have to realize that we don't know what Jesus did for sure. At least as part of the larger meal. Regardless, I promise you that even though we don't know exactly everything that would have been said and sung during that meal, There is no way that in the standard first century Passover meal, somebody takes bread, breaks it, and says, "Eat this, it's my body, which is going to be broken for you." Nobody would have done that. Because, I mean, that's weird. I mean, assume you've never heard this before. Assume, there's no such thing as a sacrament. Very briefly, for the sake of argument, please don't quote me out of context. If we were at dinner at like Olive Garden and I took some of those breadsticks and said, "This is my body, which will be broken for you tomorrow," you would look at me like there's something deeply wrong with me. And you should. But when Jesus does it, I'm sure it's clear he's not playing around. You just wonder what his disciples are thinking in that moment. Because up until this point, they've consistently not understood. And they really won't still for a little while. One of those, like, is Jesus being weird again? Like, what are you saying? And then, I know Luke has one cup that he just gives out to everybody, and then he takes another cup, and then that's the cup. Modern Seder will go through multiple cups of wine. First century Seder has at least two. I think that's all we can say about that. But nonetheless, just like with the bread, the wine is the new covenant. Now, God has made covenants with his people before. He's made one with Noah, with King David, with Abraham, Moses. Like, this is known. This is established. The number of ways that Jesus saying this is the new covenant, the number of ways that can be interpreted is pretty high. But when he says this is my blood poured out for you, after saying this is my body broken for you, I think that sets up a moment of tension that's probably going to last 12, 16 hours. Because if they don't understand in that moment, they will. And then Jesus drops this bomb saying, there's somebody's hands on the table with me that will betray me. Now, what has to happen for me, but woe to that guy. These guys have been traveling together for approximately 3 years. They know everything about each other, except for that. I mean, imagine being at a table with a bunch of your friends that you've known for a very long time, and you trust them implicitly. And then you learn that somebody at that table had murdered somebody. Whoa. What do you do? The disciples' reaction makes perfect sense. Like, they start asking each other, which makes me wonder, where's Judas? Has he slipped out yet? Because it's going to be obvious if it does. But I hope he's a good actor. Man, what do you do with that? Now again, why he did what he did, I don't know. We have some guesses. They're not important. But what I find very, very telling is easy to miss in any modern translation. If you look in your bulletin, there's a line break between the disciples going, is it you, is it you, is it you? And then what follows. And that line break probably shouldn't be there. I think Luke intends this all to just happen all at once, because there's a lot happening all at once here. There are layers that we're just going to leave unexplored. This moment is very rich. But they start going, wait, are you going to betray Jesus? Are you going to betray? Are you going to betray? And then at some point, it sounds like somebody says, no, man, I'm like the number one guy here. Because they start arguing about it. This is a very human thing. And I don't mean that in a good way. They go from, man, are you betraying? Are you? No, I'm the number one. No way, you're not. Please, if Jesus wasn't here, I would be in charge. No, and they start arguing over who should be the top guy. Now, we might say how egotistical of them, but I would say how perfectly human. And if we're mature and smart, we keep that to ourselves. But the reality is that that's usually how we see us. We don't stop and ask ever if we're actually the villain in this story. And sometimes we are. Now, Jesus, I just imagine this moment where he's dropped this bomb on them. This is a hard night for Jesus. And then they start arguing over who's the greatest, and him just going, oh. Okay, I'm going to explain this one more time because we're running out of time. And Jesus very perceptively points out, just like the Gentiles, the Greeks and Romans, and this is slightly more Greek than Roman, but it applies to the Romans as well. It's actually very perceptive of their culture. It was all about obtaining power. Power through wealth, wealth through power. You wanted to be the guy in charge, and almost certainly it would be guy. Don't shoot the messenger. That was the point. To the extent that a lot of times the Greeks didn't really care how you got in charge, they just cared what you did with that once you got it. The word tyrant in Greek is not necessarily, especially in classical Greek, is not necessarily negative, depending on what you did after that. Whereas for us, we're all about how you become in power. It's very different. And I won't go into the details for the moment, but this determined how you operated in your relationships, how you operated within your family, and actually even in your marriage. And it's not, we would look at this and say, it's not good. And so Jesus chides his disciples, not really for the last time. Like, you really want to be like that? You think this is all about power? All about who's in charge? And then he gets a little tricky to follow his logic. Because he says, who's greater? The person serving or the person who is eating at the table? Okay, so the answer to that is obviously the person eating at the table, right? All right, so one point of logic, one connection made. And then he says, am I not eating at this table? Very subtly, what he's saying here is, if anybody in this room is greater than everybody else, it's me. And it's not arrogant if it's 100% true. Okay, so Jesus is obviously the greatest. And then he says, but I've been serving you. In John's account, he washes their feet. So again, Jesus says, who's greater, the servant or the person at the table? Person at the table. I'm at the table, and I'm obviously greater than all of you, and yet I've been serving you. That is how you are going to be in this new world I'm about to inaugurate. If I could just summarize everything Jesus said right there, that's how I would. That Christians from then on, sometimes better, sometimes worse, would be known as being great by serving. By willing to do things for others. And that can be deeply unsettling. Like on the one hand, we know, right? I mean, we can recognize for the most part that if I'm the most humble servant, that's good for me. But there's a couple of pitfalls here that I think we all fall into that makes this particular passage very poignant. Because on the one hand, it can be like service manipulation. We can find ways to very subtly work the system so that we're very clearly the servant. Would you look at me? Or we can look at the idea of service from the other vantage point that being served can feel uncomfortable. You know, if somebody does something nice for you, what do you do? What do you think? Well, think, man, I should do something nice for them. Somebody takes you out to dinner and they pick up the check. Well, now we got to have them out to dinner so I can pick up the check. There's a discomfort there. But regardless, this is a new moment. This is a new idea in human history to actually say that if you want to be the greatest among everybody, serve them. That's a hard pill to swallow. Because it raises all kinds of other questions. If somebody has need, and I can meet that need, I can serve them. What if they have need I can't meet? Or what if they have need that's really, really complicated? What if their need is tied to their addiction? Then what they think they need and what they actually need are two different things. And ultimately, what they need is first to understand what they really need. I dare you to try to diagram that sentence. But I think we can all feel just how complicated that is. Or what if there's somebody who has need and presents an opportunity to serve, but there's a very blurry line between having need and being needy. In which case their needs are different. What do we do then? And then finally, we have the really uncomfortable reality where I think Jesus' words kind of sting a little. Is that what if my neighbor has need? And I just don't want to do it. It's too inconvenient. I can find some other way to justify it, but if I'm willing to be honest, I just don't want to. Then it gets hard. And that's why I think Jesus used himself as the example first. A good leader goes first. Because he's about to do something for his disciples and the rest of humanity that they can't do for themselves. Tied up to this bit of food that he handed out and then this bit of drink he handed right after. It's kind of an interesting thought. Did Jesus serve communion to Judas? I think he did. Which is an encouraging thought, because is Jesus' body and blood available to somebody like me who sees plenty of people in need of my service, but doesn't always? The answer is yes. Because that's who Jesus was. And if he was willing to serve me in my utter selfishness, then maybe I can learn to do the same. Amen.